Good morning. You're tuned in to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Justine McConville, and today you're joining me for an interview with Abby Martin, former host of Breaking the Set on RT, creator of the documentary series The Empire Files, and founder of the citizen journalism project Media Roots, here to discuss her new full-length documentary, Gaza Fights for Freedom, which premiered at the Downtown Independent Theater in Los Angeles on June 21st, 2019, at an event co-hosted by The Empire Files, Code Pink, and the Answer Coalition LA. Thank you so much for joining me today, Abby.
It's an honor to be on. Thank you so much, Justine.
Your new documentary is an absolutely staggering look at the current crisis in the Gaza Strip, and it's framed within greater historical context of occupied Palestine and the enduring fight for basic human rights and liberation. Tell me about the process of creating this film and about your collaborators here in the States and on the ground in Gaza.
Yes, so to understand how this all happened, let's go back to 2016 when my partner Mike Preisner and I were actually in the occupied West Bank, which is a devastating situation just in itself. I mean, this is a region that's been under a legal military occupation for decades, and it is under martial law. You can't protest, you can't hang a Palestinian flag. Political protest is illegal. So, of course, naturally, we wanted to go to Gaza as well because, you know, we're talking about a wholly other humanitarian crisis that is adjacent to the West Bank, that is a humanitarian disaster, one of the largest humanitarian crises in the world. We're talking about 2 million Palestinians who are living basically warehoused in what is called an open-air prison. I actually think that prisons give people more rights than people in Gaza do. They're put on a caloric diet. They don't have clean water. 95% of all water is toxic there, which is just unbelievable and unheard of in the year 2019. You know, this doesn't have to be like this. It's a manufactured crisis is what it is. Of course, there's comparable situations elsewhere in the world, but this is a manufactured crisis, and it's manufactured on behalf of Israel, who's been besieging this territory for over a decade, and warehousing these refugees who live there. And a lot of them are basically have been ethnically cleansed from villages right outside of the border of Gaza. And when we hear about clashes taking place, that's really on the border, they call it the border, that's really a misnomer. It's really just a fence partitioning these people from the lands that they really belong to and that they have the right to return to. So we wanted to get into Gaza. We were really desperate to, of course. This is a region that we're subsidizing, you know, with our tax dollars to basically perpetuate this misery. And we were banned. We were effectively banned from the Israeli government. And the reason for banning us, they said, was because we were propagandists. We weren't journalists. And then they also said that we were Iranian agents, which was confusing because I've been called many agents of many foreign governments, Tokyo Rose, you know, Venezuelan agent under Maduro. So I was like, where did this Iran agent come from? So they just didn't want us to see. I think they knew that the backlash for banning us would be far less than us actually getting into Gaza, showing the world what the reality is there. So I've been in contact with a lot of Palestinian journalists there and throughout the West Bank. I think that they trust my reporting more than they do other Western journalists, because a lot of Western journalists try to depict the situation with a both sides, you know, kind of an inaccurate lens, really. So they asked us to do this documentary, and after directing the questions and the footage, I get it back from them, and I was just absolutely blown away by how beautiful and cinematic and just incredible, astonishing footage that makes you feel like you are literally in these protests. You are on the ground with these people and you are seeing it with your own eyes. And doing a couple Empire Files episodes on our YouTube show wouldn't have done it justice. And so I knew that we had to spend every cent that we had and spend every minute that we had putting our energy into making a full-length feature film about the march. And even though there's been dozens of documentaries on Gaza, it's always painted as both sides. There's never a political advocacy message that comes out of it. It's always just kind of a helplessness saying, oh, well, this exists, and it's just this conflict's been going on forever. And so we wanted to, as activists first, put forward just a really unapologetic message of action to say, hey, they've set the path for us, and now we need to take the mantle here.
It really is such an impressive film, and you can tell it took a great community effort to pull it off. So as listeners may or may not already know, your body of work, including
most recently upwards of 100 episodes of The Empire Files, demonstrates a commitment to shining light on the sides of so many stories that the mainstream media not only omits but actively distorts. So what is your take on the mainstream media's coverage of the topic so central to this film, The Great March of Return?
I mean, it's devastating. Look, the media has been abysmal, and that's why I've been kind of lobbied to do this and also just invigorated to do it, because I just am ashamed. I'm ashamed to be even connected to the world of journalism, given the stenography of these people who call themselves journalists and really they're just servants to the U.S. empire and to the military-industrial complex and to just global capitalism. And as we know, the corporate media is subsidized by the very corporations that we should be critiquing that are essentially in control of our political establishment. So the Great March of Return, I mean, let's go back to at least just coverage of Palestine in general. I didn't even know what Palestine was until I was 19 years old, because we just grow up just thinking Israel is this free and democratic place in the Middle East. It's actually the only democracy in the Middle East, and they have the right to defend themselves. And that's what we are hammered into our skulls from birth. And until I went to college and had my eyes open about a lot of things that this government and our military was doing around the world, Palestine kind of comes along with that awakening and this global consciousness of just progressivism and taking action about these things, and as Israel is kind of a linchpin for the U.S. empire in the Middle East. There's a problem that I think people have with a misunderstanding about why Congress works in conjunction with Israel, why we protect and shield Israel from accountability, and it's not because Israel controls the U.S. Israel is a tiny country that is subsidized by the U.S. military and U.S. empire, and we use it as a military outpost to launch wars, to gain a foothold in that really strategic and crucial region of the world. And so that's a really big problem, I think, with people's consciousness of it. But the media's coverage has been absolutely atrocious. Go back to 9/11 when, you know, after the towers were hit, they showed Palestinians dancing in the streets. I mean, that's what they want you to take away. They want to conflate Palestinians struggling, besieged and under brutal occupation with like ISIS. And they want to basically make you think that, you know, this is some sort of global struggle of like clash of civilizations type stuff. And over the course of the years, it's always the same story. It's always told in the passive voice. You're always hear about Palestinians dying in mass. Who killed them? Who killed them? In the 2014 war, I'll never forget the New York Times, missile finds children on Gaza Beach. It wasn't launched at the children, it found them. It found them in the beach and it killed three boys, the Baker boys, who their bodies were mutilated on the beach just trying to play soccer. Or when a group of people were watching the World Cup during the 2014 bombing massacre, and that was, again, a missile found this, you know, patrons watching World Cup ends in, you know, devastating explosion. It's like, you fired a missile at a bar where people are watching the World Cup. Let's just call it what it is. Why are you whitewashing these atrocities? And the New York Times has been abysmal. I mean, let's go to the Great March of Return, which is shocking how you can actually depict this in any way other than what it is, which is an ongoing massacre of nonviolent peaceful protesters who are unarmed. Trust me, I've looked at hundreds of hours of this footage. I didn't see one gun. I didn't see one weapon. Where are these armed militants that we're told exist, that you're justifying these horrendous human rights abuses? So during the 2014 Great March, on May 14th, when 60 people were gunned down in cold blood by Israeli snipers, the next day, on the front page of the New York Times, it said, "Israelis reflect. I hope that every bullet was justified." And I think that really just sums it all up, that the front page of the New York Times, after something like that happens, is how did Israelis feel? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a song that's been sung a million times, and it's not going to change as much as we lobby the corporate media to change their tune. They're not going to. And that's why it's so important to have advocacy, journalism, to be really telling this through a lens of the oppressed and of the colonized. And that's what The Empire Files is. I mean, we retell these stories that have been shaped by the colonizers, by the oppressors. And it's changing now. We have social media, we have the internet, and we're kind of reclaiming the narratives that have been stolen from us and rewriting history in the eyes of the people who should be telling these stories.
One of the most practical segments of the film is the unpacking of Israel's many violations of international law. What is the nature of Israel's war crimes against the Palestinian people, and what role does the United Nations play in upholding these laws?
Mm-hmm. So there's several laws that are being violated, and let's just go to Gaza, because of course we have the apartheid state in 48 proper, which is the 50 discriminatory laws that are disproportionately affect the Arab population, the non-Jewish population, and then you have the West Bank, which is under brutal military occupation that is a complete violation of international law and has been violating UN charters for decades. And then there's Gaza, of course, which is, and this is, there were so many violations, Justine, that we actually had to take them out of the film, because I was like, this is actually just getting too legal and technical. And I'll start with those. The right to life. The right to life. The right to have a life. That's first and foremost. Then you have the right to protest, the right to not be, trapped, the right to have freedom, movement. I don't even know what charters those are because we didn't focus on them in the film, but it goes on and on and on. Then there's the targeted killings, which is a complete violation of international law. But we decided to focus on a UN report that was an investigation into the Great March atrocities that happened just in this 8-month period from March 30th, 2018 to the end, basically December 31st, 2018. We wanted to focus on this UN investigation for several reasons. We felt like people would relate to the idea of just egregious violations that have already been decided by UN law and by the international community and just the world at large. I mean, I think you actually said this to me the other day. You said, we've agreed on these terms. I mean, this is something that the world came together decades ago. Some of these charters are 100 years old and said, this is illegal. You cannot do this. You cannot target children. You cannot target disabled people. You can't target civilians. And we're talking about, let's say, if this was an armed battle between militaries, actual militaries of states, these are still egregious violations of law if we were talking about an actual war. But that's not what this is. This is, targeting of unarmed protesters who are trying to protest for their rights and to have a life and to have a life of dignity. So we decided to focus on this UN investigation because the UN investigation was incredible. I thought it was going to be some whitewashed, fake body that was just like, okay, whatever, Israel may have committed war crimes, because when they concluded their investigation, that's actually what they said. Israel may have committed war crimes. So I went into looking at this UN document thinking, all right, they can't even conclusively say that Israel committed war crimes. So how really in depth is this going to be? And it was nuts. I mean, they went through and documented every single casualty. We're talking about people who were targeted smoking a cigarette 300 meters away from the fence, people who were wrapped in a flag, people who were standing there, people who were running away, children. Again, so many children, 35 children killed over the course of this 8-month period, 900 shot, 900 children shot. And once I was reading this report, I just thought, this is the premise for the documentary. Because the report broke down these protected categories of people who were targeted. We're not just talking about civilian deaths, of course, in mass. We're talking about actual protected categories, which makes it that much more egregious and blatant. And so we decided to focus on the children, medics, journalists are another protected category. At least 3 journalists have been killed that were clearly marked press, dozens more shot and wounded that were clearly marked press. And disabled. I mean, several people on crutches. There was 2 double amputees that were shot and killed while they were in their wheelchairs. I mean, when you kind of read these stories and you personalize these stories, and it stops becoming just a number and a statistic, and then it really makes you realize how important it is to tell some of these individual stories. And because people hear these numbers and they sound crazy, and then you say, but did you know that a 14-year-old girl was killed when she was just wrapped in a flag? Did you know that this kid was handing out sandwiches to the demonstrator and he was shot and killed and shot in the head? Like, that's when I think it really becomes real. And then, of course, just the international law part, I wanted to really reestablish that these laws have been set in stone, and Israel's flagrantly violating them. in so many ways. And the UN has a right, they have a responsibility to uphold these resolutions, and they've tried to hold Israel accountable many times at the UNGA. And unfortunately, there's about five countries that have veto power at the UNGA, and the US is one of them. And as long as the US empire will continue to veto any attempt to hold Israel accountable, nothing will move forward. And in situations before, like in the 2014 massacre in Gaza, where, you know, 2,200 Palestinians were killed, massacred, and 500 children were killed in that massacre, even countries in the UN weren't as steadfast as they are now. Because I think now it's really as plain as day. There's no hiding the fact that all of this is actually on camera. You can see with your own eyes. There's no rockets being fired. There's no smoke obscuring your vision. You really can see this happening real time. And that's why we did the UN basis, and that's why it's so important to understand that the next step needs to be holding Israel accountable in international courts, and to actually charge them with these violations of law and have a legal framework to do so. And so we wanted to structure the film in that way so we can continue that movement of advocacy.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in, this morning I'm speaking with Abby Martin about her new full-length documentary film, Gaza Fights for Freedom.
In a powerful moment early in the film, your voice narrates, "Trapped in this place, you'll find much more than misery. You find happiness, love, and joy. Yet Gaza is not defined by how it copes with oppression, but by its struggle for freedom." What continues to inspire and give you hope for the Palestinian people in their fight for freedom?
I wanted to first address that line, because when the Palestinians in Gaza were telling me what they wanted to portray with the film, they also wanted to show that they had happiness, that they have love, because they're portrayed in the mass media here as like they are a death cult. I mean, look no further than like Sam Harris and Bill Maher. I mean, these people who are so-called liberals perpetuate this talking point that Palestinians worship death, because they use the terminology of martyrs. They, you know, they put posters on the wall when people are killed or, you know, put in jail, and that's because they honor the dead. I mean, death is such a common occurrence for them that they've like normalized it to a certain extent, where you put up the heroes in the community who have sacrificed themselves for the cause. And that's not to say that they wanted to die, that's that they keep getting killed. And so it's only the only way that they can cope. But they did tell me that they want Americans to know they don't want to die. They want to live. And how sick is it that they have to tell me that? That that's the message that they need Americans to hear. That's how brainwashed we are. And honestly, their hope and resilience gives me hope and gives me life. I mean, I'm coming from an extremely privileged point of view. I'm a white American who's living in Los Angeles, and seeing the struggle on a daily basis that they go through, whether it be the water crisis, you know, unpotable water that the UN says is going to be uninhabitable by 2020, or the lack of electricity, as Ahmad Sabo, one of the gentlemen in the film, said. He said, "Electricity is as important as the air we breathe." And that really struck me, because I said, look, if these people, you know, not only are they finding hope and inspiration in such a devastating climate, what gives us the right to not have hope and inspiration for, you know, this, especially having solidarity and trying to propel their voices, because they don't have the means to propel their own voices. And so that's the least that we can do for them. But I think that the biggest moment in the film and in the footage that gave me the strength is this kind of rite of passage where the Palestinians go out and throw stones. And this is something that was adopted during the first and second intifadas as a mostly symbolic action, of course. You know, of course, stones can give you scratches. And I'm sure if you're outside of the tank and it hits you in the head, you can get, you know, a headache from these little pebbles. I mean, they're like literally pebbles that these Palestinians throw as part of their rite of passage. They know that they're not going to hurt someone with it. It's just something that they do. And of course, Israel uses that to justify executing them. But seeing them go out one by one and throw these stones at these tanks and at this fortified military, knowing that it can come with a death sentence, and it often does. And so to see them throw the stones and go out there one after the other to do this symbolic act, and, you know, and to go up and put the flag on the fence and run back, and it's all just part of this rite of passage for them again. And, you know, and Razan's story was so meaningful to me because she knew the stakes, and all of them know the stakes. They know that people are getting killed. And of course, they're killing all these people to deter them. They want to kind of eliminate the struggle, but that's not stopping them. They're doing it, knowing the risks, and it doesn't mean that they're not scared. Razan told her mom. She said, "Mom, they're not going to kill me. I'm wearing a medic coat." And I think that the strength that she had, knowing the risks and knowing that they were targeting all these people, I mean, that gives me strength and that gives me hope that they're scared, but they still do it because they know that they have to. And they're doing it so we can listen. And we have to listen to them, and we have to take cues from them, and we have to gain our hope from their message.
Yep, such an incredible act of resilience. Your work always has a way of empowering the audience, enlightening them, and then equipping them with tools for change. What is your hope for the impact of this film, and how can concerned citizens get involved in this movement?
We have to just take the cue from Palestinians. So they, you know, it's no longer up to us to say, oh, what can we do? They've told us, this is what you can do. This is what you have to do. Don't feel bad for us. Don't just sympathize with us. They said, we want our rights, and we've set the path for justice, for the reclamation of our rights to implement the UN Charter, you know, 164, that says that they have the right to return to the lands that they were ethnically cleansed from, because they just want to live in peace. They want to, you know, have their freedom of movement and have their dignity back. And they've not only given us this legal framework, which is really clear as day, of all the violations of law that we can actually bring Israel to international courts and hold them accountable at The Hague and at the ICC and at the UN. But they've also just set the path for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And I want to clarify that I oppose sanctions to, you know, countries like Venezuela, of course. That's why my show was shut down. That is not the same thing. I actually advocate people BDSing the U.S. government, too. Like, I think that that's the only way that we can actually fight countries that are large military states, that are rogue outliers, that are just, you know, they don't adhere to laws and they don't adhere to human rights. And there's so much distortion and propaganda surrounding, you know, why they can do that and why they should continue doing that. And so I think that the only way to stop not only Israel, but the U.S. empire, because it goes hand in hand. U.S. empire is protecting Israel and shielding them. And that's why I advocate BDS. And this is a strategy that works. We saw it work in South Africa. You know, white people in South Africa didn't just wake up one day and say, oh, I'm not going to be racist anymore. They were isolated and they were forced into that position from the international community. It came from academic boycotts. It came from cultural boycotts. And it came from financial boycotts. And there's so many products and corporations profiting off this occupation. And that's really like the cue that we need to take also, is that there's no hope for within Israeli society. There's tons of progressives there. There's a left presence there, and I've been in contact with them. And they agree that things are getting worse. And when you have a settler colonial state based on the continuous ethnic cleansing of the indigenous population, that is an ongoing process. And when you are trying to annex all the land to this day, it kind of cultivates fascism naturally. And it doesn't matter how Israel started. All that matters is what's happening now. And we see just a further right, further fascist kind of coalition gaining a foothold. And with the most recent election, I mean, it was basically a push between the far-right secular government and the far-right orthodox government, and the left had no presence there, and there is no oscillation, there's no pendulum that's going to swing. And so BDS is the tool that we need, and I think it really scares people. As we know, Congress, one of the first bipartisan efforts during the government shutdown, was actually trying to pass anti-BDS measures here, because they know the tide is turning, they know the wave of consciousness is spreading exponentially, and the only thing that they can do is try to criminalize our non-violent efforts of resistance to stand in solidarity with Palestinians. But at the same time, that is going to happen. It is going to work. And I think that there's a huge misnomer around this entire issue, because people say, what does that mean for Israel? What does that mean for my Jewish brothers and sisters who are living within Israel proper? What does that mean for my Jewish brothers and sisters who are Israeli who hear BDS and they hear the one state solution and they think that means expelling all the Jews. And no, it doesn't. It means dissolving this exclusivity of an exclusive Jewish only state and just granting equal rights to the Arab population that the Jewish population also shares. It doesn't mean kicking anyone out. It means cohabitating, and it means living in peace with equal rights. And anyone who's been to the West Bank knows that that's honestly the only solution that can come out of this. And so I hope that this movie is a really clear-cut tool for people to take away and kind of break through all the propaganda and the myths and the Hasbro and say, no, Israel has violated all of these laws. There's clear-cut, grievous violations of laws, you know, the protected categories of the Geneva Conventions, all the civilians that have been killed. Not only build that legal framework to try to build the pressure to take Israel to court, but most importantly, try to really encourage BDS and boycotting Israel on the smallest scales, really. You know, my friend works as she sells hair products, and there's a lot of, like, product from the Dead Sea. And she, after seeing the film, she actually wrote to her boss and said, I do not feel comfortable selling these products anymore. And I don't think we understand the ripple effects that that has in a community and the inspiration that that can carry on for someone else to take action, as small or large as it may seem. I mean, whether it's the Sabra hummus in your cafeteria or vending machine to actually buying products, you know, SodaStream, to just having the discussion with friends, colleagues, and neighbors about what the reality is, and getting people to really understand the severity of the situation and why we have a unique obligation as American citizens. I can't stress that enough. It's so different than any other country in the world. And honestly, a lot of other countries in the world are way further than us on this issue, like they are with socialized medicine, the environment. I mean, Ireland just passed like a BDS resolution. Like, wow, that's mind-blowing. And we're so far behind. But we do have a unique role to play, because we are the children of the empire and we are literally making this happen with our tax dollars on a daily basis. And that's why we need to not only advocate BDS, but advocate, you know, BDS against this government and advocate just a strong mobilizing grassroots effort to stop the US empire from carrying out, you know, the wars around the world and subsidizing criminal states like Saudi Arabia and Israel. And that's where the struggle needs to be.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me about your newly released documentary, Gaza Fights for Freedom.
Thank you so much for having me.
Find more of Abby Martin's work at theempirefiles.tv. And for more information about how to host a screening in your community, visit gazafightsforfreedom.com. This has been Justine McConville reporting for KBOO Radio.